Yeah, I don't know how long I'm supposed to be going. Well, we didn't have too bad of attrition after lunch. This is a tough session. This is when all the blood's in your stomach. And there we go. Start to. Charlie Parker, alcoholic. Oh, man. I've been talking a lot. My voice does okay up here, but it's when we're in the cafeteria or I'm trying to talk loud, but it doesn't hurt. It just sounds like geese farts, but Leo Kottke said that one time. Anybody remember Leo Kottke, the guitar player? He had this blazing guitar licks, but he claimed that when he sang, it sounded like geese farts. But okay, this thing that Katie was talking about, the self piece, we call it, pages 60 to 63, it changes everything about the way we go through the steps. And like I was talking about, when we're trying to talk about what's going to be different, this is a huge piece. This is a whole different approach because it changes my sobriety picture from drink, don't drink, drink, don't drink. You know, if I'm not drinking, I get an A. And then, but when you're working a program based on the abstinence of alcohol, one of the things that's confusing about it is that physical sobriety starts to look like recovery. Because when I'm not drinking, I get a new truck, I get some money in the bank, things go better. But on that basis, lines like this one on page 19 are a little stunning because it says, we feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. Now, demonstrates another word we looked up that I found interesting one time. This will blow your mind. It said, to demonstrate is to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt, to prove to the point that the opposite viewpoint is rendered absurd. So when we get to the fear inventory, and it says we let God I get to that when we get to the fear inventory. But this demonstrate thing is like to prove this. And it's saying a much more important demonstration of our principles, a lot more important than not drinking. I mean, I remember thinking, how can it be more important than not? This is Alcoholics Anonymous, right? But it's saying, you know, that the elimination of our drinking has been a beginning. And there's another place in the book where it says, I think it's very kind the way they worded it. They said, we feel that a man is unthinking when he said, I'm going to use that sometime, unthinking, you know, but when he says sobriety is not enough. It changes. So now, you got this bigger picture in sobriety, and a lot of times I'm working the steps now to stay out of the bedevilments. You know, I mean, now the drink is back there, and the drink is still, you know, I mean, Bill Wilson one time said that in Alcoholics Anonymous we have two ultimate authorities. We got God saying, if you'll come to me, I'll take care of you. And they said, but we've also got, he called it John Barleycorn, but he said, we got John Barleycorn saying, if you mess around with this deal too much, I'll kill you. You know, so it's kind of like I have a little more inspiration than my mother has to seek. She does it just to seek spiritual, you know, context, and I'm doing it to keep from dying. You know, but when we change this picture, now it changes, and I can't emphasize these pages 60 to 63 too much because Katie did a great job of going over it, but you know, when it's so textbook when it says, you know, the play doesn't suit me, I become angry, indignant, self-pitying, you know, what is my basic trouble? And it goes on, and so when we switch over to this selfishness piece, I missed a lot of what Katie was doing because I had to take a phone call upstairs when I went up to take some Advil, but did she hit the above everything, Jeb? Where it says above everything, I'll never forget, we read that line in Mark Houston. It says above everything, we must be rid of the selfishness. And Mark looked me right in the eye one day and he goes, what do the words above everything mean to you? And I'm like, well, I guess, you know, like paramount importance. And he goes, isn't it interesting that it doesn't say above everything, we got to stop drinking vodka? You know, it's basically saying that vodka never was the problem. vodka was the only thing I ever found that would ease the discomfort of a life based on selfishness and self-centeredness. Now we're talking, because now it's like if we don't reduce the self, whatever that means, then we're going to get so uncomfortable that a drink's going to look like a good idea. When I need that relief, and it's not even going to feel insane when I do it, it's going to feel like the next indicated action, you know, is to get loaded, and here we go again. And over in the book, it brings us to a place where it says, okay, Charlie, here's the problem. It doesn't say Charlie, but the book brings me to places all the time where it says, okay, here's the problem. You know, do you have it? Yes. Do you think it's objectionable? Yes. And here's the bad news. You can't do a darn thing about it on your own power. It happens over and over and over again where it brings me to this place of lack of power, you know, and we couldn't get over it. We couldn't wish it away any more than we could alcohol. And so it says God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of getting rid of self without God's aid. And as she hit that thing about the moral and philosophical, neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. It'd be nice if we could come to one of these talks and go, you know, that knucklehead from Texas is right. I am going to be less selfish. I think I'll probably go down to the soup kitchen this week. It's like it's just we can't reduce. It's in my DNA, and we say stuff that shocks normal people. I had a guy that worked for me that went to work for the guy I just showed you the picture of, and he's the guy he went to work for after me. The guy that worked for me was AA. He's 9 months less than me. When he went to work for Don told me one time, he goes, you know, his level of self-centeredness is sometimes breathtaking. And I was like, oh, he worked for me for 9 years. I get it. You know, where like, you know, you'd give him a raise and he'd go, well, that's just going to put me in a higher tax bracket. And I'm gonna, you're like, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay, you know, I mean, but it goes, see, that's where it switches to this. When it gets me to this place of no power is where it switches to this is the how and why of it. It switches from what we mean to what we do. And it talked about that whole quit playing God. I just did all that to emphasize. I want to get to the top of page 63, because when it talks about, on page 42, it talks about, we find it, I think it's 42, 46, where it says we find that God doesn't make too hard terms for those that seek him. Well, these are the terms of the deal I make. I call this, at the bottom of 62, I call that the deal. And what's the deal? The deal is that I'm no longer in management, you know, and it says, because it says we had to quit playing God. Next, we decided. Now, here's the third step decision. The third step prayer is just a reiteration of this decision we've made at the bottom of page 62. And it says, next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God's going to be our director. And it gives us three examples. He's the principal. We're his agents. He's the father. We're his children. And it says, so that's the deal, is that I'm no longer in management, right? And then at the top of page 63, it gets into what I call the terms of the deal. And what are the terms of the deal? It says, when we sincerely took such a position, what position? The position that God's in charge, and that suits me just fine. Because usually this second surrender takes place after we've been sober for a while and trying to manage our own lives in sobriety, whether it's 5 years, 15 years. I mean, we go, okay, take it. You know, I mean, because it says when we and so this position is that God's in charge and that suits me just fine. And then it says when we sincerely took this position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. And here's the terms of the deal. It says we had a new employer. This is a super simple equation. It says being all powerful, he provided what we needed under two conditions. If we stay close to him and perform his work well. And the crazy thing about it is from here on out, there's nothing else. Everything we do from here on out is either about staying close to him or performing his work well. And then it gives those third step promises. Yeah, we've been missing you, honey.
You're still in the third step?
I'm exactly where I told you I was going to be. Because this the thing about this deal, have you ever looked at an airline route map and they have hub cities and you know, like for Delta, it's like Atlanta and you see all these lines and this is like the hub of the big book. It's, you know, everything we do from here forward, it refers back to this, refers back to this. And all throughout my book, I've got places where in the border I put restates the deal, restates step three, restates the deal. It keeps taking me back to these places where it says he'll stay close to him and perform his work well. It's a pretty good, you know, deal. You know, if I stay close to him and perform his work well, he'll perform. And I can tell you that he's been doing a pretty good job of it. You know, and so it says we were now we do the third step prayer, and then it talks about, you know, it's funny because they do all this work and they tell you to do the third step prayer, and then they tell you to think well, you know, before. But I've only had one guy so far think well before we did it. He was like, I put my best third step pitch on him. He goes, you know, I think I want to just think about this for a little while. And like, okay, you know. And but then after that, it's where we go into the. It turns out this vigorous course of action that the book describes, I used to think it was the fourth step. Now I think it's steps 4 through 9. And it refers to this deal because what it's saying is it says stay close to him and perform his work well. Well, I can't stay close to this power until I get close to this power. And I can't get close to this power when I'm blocked, right? And so everything we're going to do in 4 through 9 is about getting me unblocked from this power. I have a little graphic that I use. I don't think you'll be able to see it, but you know, I've got a few drawings in the back of my book. I got the terrible cycle, but then I've also got this pipeline that shows me on one end and God on the other, and my pipe is clogged up with resentment and fear and shame and pride and hurt feelings and fear and selfishness and all this stuff. And so what we're going to try to do is at least remove enough of what's blocking me that there can be some flow of power between me and some flow of grace between me and this power. So that's what it says next. I hate to steal this joke, but our buddy Scott Lee, he says, he's a big book technician, and the highest compliment, my highest goal is to be what would be described as a big book step worker. That's what Gary Brown says. That's, you know, working the steps out of the big book. I mean, Gary was Don Pritz's sponsor. Don Pritz sponsored Mark Houston. Mark Houston sponsored me, and Pritz sponsored a lot of people that I really admire. And one of my favorite stories was Gary Brown was part of this Denver Young People's Group, and he's sober like 57 years now, I think. And this guy named Mac Cheater came down from Canada, and he was a big book step worker. And he came down and he did this workshop for him, and Gary says, why don't we get a group of us together and go through this book, and when it tells us to do something, we'll do it. And if it tells us to pray, we'll pray. If it tells us to think, we'll think. If it tells us to write it down, we'll write it down. There were 13 people in that group of people that did that exercise. And 50 years later, one of them died in a relapse and died in a snowdrift out wandering around in the snow. The other 12 either died sober or are still sober. You know, to me, that's a pretty good example of the power of working these steps out of the big book. And if you look at that forward to the second edition, where it talks about 50% of us got sober and stayed sober, and 25 of the ones that relapsed, 25% came back and stayed sober, and even the ones that stayed, if they stayed around, they got better. You know, they're talking about like an 85% success rate. And I think we can still get those kind of success rates with people who came to us and really tried. Because that's what it says in the forward to second. It says, of those of us who came to us and really tried, and it gives those statistics. So it says, but Scott one time, he said, I try to be as open-minded as possible with my sponsees. And he goes, there's two time references on when to start. Because one time we had somebody go, are you one of these people that believes in taking people through the steps really fast? And I'm like, no, I mean, not really fast. I mean, couple of weeks, you know. And she thought I was being a wise guy, but if you really look at the way the process, it depends on how much time we have together and that sort of thing. But Scott said, he goes, there's two time references to when to start your four-step meeting. He said, I tell my guys, you can do it on the first time reference or the second time reference or anywhere in between. And I think it's fair. Katie, when you walk around, everybody looks at you. I'm losing the room here. Yeah. Did you get another flight?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That's Danny Brown right there. He's our speaker tonight. I can't wait for you to hear Danny tonight. So it says, he says, back to this two-time references on when to start the four-step. It says, next, we launched out on a vigorous course of action. Right? So next is a time reference. And then it goes on to say, which many of us had never attempted, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which were blocking us. So at once is a time reference. So you can start the fourth step next or at once, or anywhere in between. It's really pretty fair, you know. But when it's, what did he say we're going to try to do? What are we trying to do in this vigorous course of action? It says, unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which are blocking us. See, that referred. Could you get me a glass of water? It refers back to that pipeline. The things that are blocking me is what we're going to try to address in this inventory process. Thank you so much. Therefore is a funny word. In the book, therefore means as reference to earlier. So whenever you see therefore, you got to ask yourself, what's that therefore? Therefore. And they're referring back, based on this previous paragraph, we started on a personal inventory, which is step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Now, here's a line I really love. It says, taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. Well, I used to, the first time I did an inventory, my sponsor just sat there and listened to me read my four step. And I used to think that's what I did. I would just sit there and let them read their four step to me. I've changed my take on that. Now when it says we're on a fact finding and a fact facing mission, I think my job is the fact finding and his job is the fact facing, because they're not always capable of seeing it from an entirely different angle. So a lot of times when I'm listening to somebody read inventory, I like to say I'm in the entirely different angle business, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, what would be another take on this? Where is self showing up? Where do they make decisions based on self? The place them in a position to be harmed and that sort of thing. And you can start, and sometimes it's almost like being a news reporter where, you know, as you're doing inventory, I'm going, how many kids were in your family? And where did you grow up? And how was the money situation? And where did you fall in that group of kids? And how was all that, you know? And you can start to shape a dialogue, and you'll hear yourself saying stuff I've never said to anybody else before. But it goes on to say, one object is to get rid of unsaleable damaged goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. We're just going to find these things and try to get rid of them. But I can't fool myself. And then it says, we did exactly the same thing with their lives. They took stock honestly. First, they searched out the flaws in their makeup, which had caused their failure. Now listen to this. If I miss the self piece in the third step, I mean, I'm a little thick, but, you know, when we talk about this confirmation bias, where when I'm studying the book, I'm not looking for new information, I'm just looking for confirmation of ways I'm already right. We talked about that last night, didn't we? You know, yeah, well, this is if I missed it in the third step, where it says, first requirement is that I be convinced it might, but what did I do when I got to the fourth step? It says, being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. Well, I've written in there, am I? You know, am I convinced that self manifested in various ways? Because think about it. Over on page 60, It says the first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And over here it says being convinced. So that tells me that these three pages right here have been trying to convince me that my life based on self-will is going to be a mess. And it says being, and if I'm convinced, and remember, manifested means the way it shows up. So being convinced that self manifested in various ways is what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Its being what? Being self's. So if you kind of turn that sentence around a little bit, it's basically saying that the fourth step is a consideration of common manifestations of self. My first fourth step was just kind of a confession about stuff I felt bad about. It wasn't a terrible exercise, but I think there's more freedom available in this approach. And so it's back to that new guy, the one that said, what do you mean and what do we do? I also think it'd be a fair question for him to go, okay, if you're telling me self is what's killing me, I don't get it. What are we talking about? What am I looking for? And they go, well, let's look at some of the common ways that it shows up. And when, and so then we launch into that. And the number one way that self shows up is in resentment. I think it's brilliant that they do resentment first, because I may not be too open about my feelings and stuff when I get here, but I can tell you who I'm pissed off at. You know, and we start off with resentments, and it says it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Even alcohol. It says resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we've not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So even though we've talked about the physical and the mental plane of alcoholism, we don't attack it on the physical plane or the mental plane. We attack it on the spiritual plane, and then we straighten out mentally and physically. I think it's fascinating that when you get over into the 10th step, this one used to bug me. In the 10th step promises, it says, we will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. Did that used to bug anybody? I remember reading that and going, what do they mean, not no effort on my part? I've been showing up at my sponsor's house. I've been writing inventory. But none of that inventory was around. When I say the book takes a right turn on page 60, none of that work has been centered around alcohol. From page 60, we switched to talking about selfishness, self-centeredness, the way it manifests, resentment, fear, harms to others, sexual stuff. And then we pop up over here on page 84 and go, wow, I haven't thought about drinking in a minute. You know, it says we find that our new attitude has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. Well, so there's a lot to cover in here, and there's a lot of guides on how to work the inventory, but my experience, I don't think people are dying from doing the inventory wrong. I think they're dying from not doing it at all. And so I want to kind of speed through some of this, because there's pieces that are pretty common to the way people approach the inventory. But there's been some new stuff that I've worked with that has really helped me. So remember this three-column thing on page 65? Anybody ever look at that and go, whatever, you know, I mean, right, you know, because it's hard to follow a little bit. You know, Mr. Brown, and he's hitting on my wife, and all that. Well, there's more to it than that, but it says in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people. One of the things that's confusing about this is I always looked at it like it went across the page like that. But if you read it the way it lays out in the book, it kind of goes down like that. We listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. Then the second column, we asked ourselves why we were angry. And then the third column is how did it affect me? You know, and it says my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my ambitions. Now, when I talk about ambitions, I talk about the way I wanted things to turn out, you know, is affected my ambitions. You know, so if something didn't go the way I wanted it to go, it's affected my ambitions. And my favorite example that I always use is Mr. Brown, because one of the things we talk about is we're hitting bullet points in this inventory process. It's not the great American novel. I mean, and look at Brown. It says, he's hit his attention to my wife. He told my wife I've got a mistress. And he's trying to get my job at the office. I mean, the best AA t-shirt ever is the one that says, Mr. Brown needs his ass kicked. You know, I mean, and when you look at all the things he's done, he's hitting on my wife. And one of the ways he tried to make that go is to say, oh, and by the way, he's got a girlfriend anyway, you know, and he's trying to get my job. He got 19 words in the second column. You know, it's just my dad, this, that. And then we're going to fluff it out in the fourth column. But how it affects me, my sex relations, my self-esteem, my security, my pride, that sort of thing. But I want to get over to page 66 because this is where we start getting some real meat on the bone. It says, to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. Y'all with me on that one? I mean, I can hang right there. Chad... we have a meeting at my house called The Common Solution, and we want to be one voice, one message, whichever one of my guys you're talking to. So we get together on Thursday nights, and we talk about this process. We've been doing it originally it was me and Mark Houston and all my sponsees. And, you know, we've been doing it for, God, at least 16, 17 years, I guess. And I'll talk some more about some of the stuff that happened about that. But we read some inventory sometimes. We'll read inventory, you know, about what we got going on. And have you all seen that Big Book Awakening where it has the expanded third column? And Katie works with that expanded third column where instead of just saying it affects my self-esteem, it really fluffs out how it affects my self-esteem, and I need my pride's got to be set aside for my self-esteem to be intact, and the fear, it kind of works its way up and down, and they call that the expanded third column. And when I'm doing inventory, I tend to keep going back to talking about what they did and whose fault it was, and Chad called that my expanded second column one time, because you know? I kept finding myself drifting back to what they did, you know. But here's where the freedom comes in. It says, the usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments, you know, and this thing about... sometimes you can win a battle and it's not really a clear victory. And this is, I have a very recent example. If anybody's been watching the Johnny Depp Amber Heard, you know, I'm like, when they awarded it to him, I'm like, there's no clear winners in this thing. I mean, it's like they've been drugged through the mud. I had a patent infringement lawsuit like that one time that I won, but it cost me $60,000 to, and you're like, yay. You know, I mean, Confucius one time said when two tigers fight, one is killed and one is mortally injured. You know, it's like there's not, and so it's saying, you know, as in war, the victor only seemed to win. And it talks about it's plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Do I believe that? To the precise extent that we permit these deep resentments, do we squander the hours which might have been worthwhile? But with the alcohol, it's going to threaten my life about six times on this page. And it says, but the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, the insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. So it goes on to say, if we were to live, so this little exercise is really only for those of us that want to live. It's, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. We looked up brainstorm one night. Brainstorm changed in the 60s with Walt Disney, and he would get groups together about a movie, and they called it brainstorming. But if you look it up in that old dictionary we got, it says sudden and violent mental outburst. And you're like, it sounds like rage. You know, it's saying the grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious, doubtful luxury of normal men, but for us, these things are poison. So here's the thing. For years, that inventory only had three columns. It was just who harmed me, what they did, and how it affected me. But now we're going to get to, there's two more columns. I don't care why, but I could actually call mine a five-column inventory, but it's definitely a four-column inventory with a little bitty box. You know what? I tell guys when they're going to write inventory, get out a spiral notebook and put a line down the middle, up almost to the middle of this page, and a line down the middle of this page, and you got four columns. And then I'll put a little bitty line right here that just leaves room for a check mark. And the check mark is for when they've done this exercise here that we call the sick man prayer. And it says, we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. That's it, just the key to the future. And it says, they were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. And here's where we turn statements into questions. Are you prepared to look at, I ask guys when they're doing inventory, are you prepared to look at this from a different angle? And sometimes we can even say, why? You know, why are you prepared to look at it from a different angle? And because most of the time, I don't know, we were talking about resentment one time at the table on Thursday night, and this doctor that meets with us, he goes, but what about the times when you're right? And I go, oh, buddy, see, that's the thing. I always go in thinking I'm right. You know, I mean, that would be every one of them. And it says, because sometimes when you're saying are you prepared to look at it from a different angle, I'm like, well, okay, but why? I mean, this is a stupid exercise because I saw exactly what happened, you know, and it goes on to say, we began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. I love it the way Katie says that. It's that's all that's really going to give me trouble is the world and its people, you know, and it says in that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, right? It doesn't even have to be reality. Has the power to kill. How could we escape? Well, here it is again. We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but we couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. So here's another place where the book is saying, here's the problem. You think it's objectionable, and you can't do anything about it on your own. And then, so here's this little piece that I missed for a long time, and there's so much freedom in it. I work with this chunk a lot when I'm here in inventory from my guys. And it says, we realized that this was their course. This was the course our founders took. It says, they realized that the people who wronged them were perhaps spiritually sick. Well, in some cases, it doesn't necessarily mean they're a whole lot sicker than I am. But they're just having a human experience kind of like I am. But the problem is, see, remember back when we talked about even though my motives were good, and then there's this delusion that if people would only do as I wish, the show would come. Well, see, that's the thing. I build this funnel that one side up is made up of my motives. The other side of the funnel is made up of this delusion I have that if you guys would have just acted right, we'd all been better off. When I run my actions through that funnel and they come out the bottom, about the worst I'm ever going to give myself is an A-. You know, I mean, maybe it screwed up a little bit, but there's a lot of good reasons why it screwed up, and none of them are my fault. But when you foul up, I don't run it through the same funnel. It's just an outrage, and I demand justice, and that's so. It's mercy for me, justice for you, and so. One of the things that Bob D talks about is that in this exercise, it's almost like we were in a courtroom, and the person on my resentment list was the defendant, and I'm the prosecutor. And it's like, what if you got up from the prosecution table and walked over and hired on to the defense? What would you be saying? Because these people I'm mad at, they're not going to tell it the same way. They're not going to go, well, I just woke up one morning and thought, how can I jack with Charlie today? You know, I mean, so we look at it from, because I don't spend much time thinking about what their motives were and what was going on. And if we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, what was driving them? You know, and what kind of background do they have? And what, like Chris says, what amount of dealage do they have to handle a situation like this? And it brings about a compassion that I don't bring into this thing. And you know, one of my favorite examples is that guy Roy that I've been talking about for years, that is He was 12, and he was sitting on the front steps of his house, and his dad came walking in, and walked past him, and says, your mom killed herself today. And he had this resentment for his whole life. How could anybody be that heartless, that thoughtless? And you could get a lot of support for that in the rooms of AA or in inventory sometime. But when we did it, I took a different approach, and I said, are you prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle? And he goes, yeah, because I've been talking to him the whole time. How many kids were in your family? How was the – he said, there was 3 kids, 2 years apart. I was in the middle. How was the – were your parents still together? Yeah. And he goes, so how was the money situation? He goes, it was okay. My dad was a welder. I mean, we weren't, like, rolling in it, but we were okay. And I go, and so your mom had a lot of mental illness and stuff over the years? And he said, yeah. And I said, a lot of drama within the family. And I said, he goes, yeah. And he goes, and on this day, she has killed herself. And he said, yeah. And I go, so did it ever occur to you, now your dad, and you're 12, I'm guessing your dad's what, you know, in his, I mean, if he's probably mid-30s or so. And he goes, is it possible this welder in his early to mid-30s, now he's got to leave work, he's got to come home, he's got to prepare himself for a funeral. He's got to tell everybody in the family that his wife committed suicide. He's got to risk the judgment of everybody in this small town y'all lived in. And in the meantime, he's got to figure out how to make a living and raise 3 kids on his own. And I said, is it possible that on that day when he walked by, the best that he was able to do was to say, your mom killed herself today. And he said, my favorite thing to hear somebody say when we're in this fourth column or in this sick man exercises, he went, oh my God. Because I see it over and over and over again. He said, I'll never forget it. He goes, I never considered my dad for a moment. I never gave 1 ounce of thought to what was going on with my dad. All I could think about was how it affected me. And see now how it's a manifestation of self-centeredness? You know, because when they say that, oh my God, they're just going, how can I be that self-centered? You know, I didn't give any thought at all to them. And over and over and over again, I've seen where I come into this inventory process with a big resentment. I see it from an entirely different angle. And look how this exercise is cleverly wedged between the third column and the fourth column to move me into a place where now I can look where I was selfish, where I was frightened, where I was self-seeking, and that sort of thing. And I go in and I'm looking at that and I'm going, because it says disregarding the other person entirely, we resolutely looked at our own mistakes. But that sick man exercise, when they've done that little prayer, you know, I ask them, you know, because it says, and even if somebody has harmed me, where, like, it's time for Katie's pills. Just a minute. She takes a bucket full of supplements every day. Charlie Parker? sometimes when we're doing this sick man exercise, sometimes if it's physical abuse or sexual abuse and stuff like that, I'm not saying, you know, we're going to necessarily go hang out with them, but at a minimum, when it says they were perhaps spiritually sick, somebody that was spiritually connected wouldn't have the capacity to exhibit that behavior. So at a minimum, I can just try to be more forgiving of that, and I don't have to go. But I've seen more freedom in this exercise. And it says we ask God. And it's funny because you hear a lot about praying for the person we resent, and that's in the story in the back. It's not a bad exercise, but that's not what it's saying to do here. It says we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerily grant a sick friend. I was doing inventory with one of Katie's girls one time. I was reading it to her. I can remember, I don't get to hear their inventory. And she says, you know, that word show, where it says we ask God to show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience. And she said, I see that word show as a call to action. It's asking me to demonstrate tolerance, compassion, and patience to this person like we would if they were sick or mentally ill or whatever. You know, it says, when a person offended, we said this to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And right there in my book, I've written, restate step three. But I don't think I finished my story about the airlines. Is it? Yes, I did. I talked about the route map with all the lines coming. See, here's one that goes back to the deal we made on page 63. It says, how can I be helpful? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. And then we avoid retaliation argument. This comes in handy at your home group. It says we avoid retaliation or argument. Why? Because it says if we do retaliate or argue, we destroy our chance of being helpful. You know, if I, there's some situations where if I take a real aggressive approach, I'm not the guy they're going to come to when they're looking for help, you know, because I've destroyed that opportunity to be helpful. We can't be helpful to, here's a huge promise, we cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. That's that sick man exercise. I've never seen it on any four-step guides I've ever seen. It's right out of the book. And when my guys do that on the person that was in column one, I have them put a little check mark there. You know, my mom, I go through this exercise, check. You know, did I do it with my dad? Check, you know, and that sort of thing. Look at what happens then. It says we're referring to our list again, put it out of our minds, the wrongs of it. Then we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened? Those situations have not been entirely our fault. We tried to disregard the other person entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. To me, I mean, I've heard people say there's no fourth column. Whatever you want to call this body of work on 67, but it says, you know, we listed them. We write it down, and it says we put them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. But when you see all the self in the sick man exercise, and then you roll that into the fourth column, that's what I was starting to say, is I can't tell you how many times where I've come in with a burning resentment, seeing it from another angle, seeing how selfish I was in it, and I go out the other end with an amends to go make. It happens over and over and over again, where I come in and I go, it turns out my take was so self-centered. You know, it's like with Roy and his daddy, it's like, I've been waiting 40 years for him to apologize to me. I need to go find him tomorrow and make amends to him, you know? And I mean, and I watched a 40-year resentment just go, just like that. I've seen it happen over, I've seen it happen to me. And, and one of the things that we talk about though sometimes is that the ego can even turn this process into an exercise in self-will, because sometimes I don't even know it, but I edge God right out of the process. I was sitting at my table one time, and it says, did you do evening review? Were you resentful? If so, write a four-column inventory. So I'd write a little inventory, and I go, I'm mad at this person. Here's what they did. I've seen it from a different angle, and I go, wow, I was really selfish in that. And I go, oh, I'm glad I did that. I'm really feeling a lot better. God didn't have anything to do with it. You know, very subtly, I've turned it into an exercise in self-will, where I've just looked at it from a different angle. So there's a piece where we take God and ask him to it, but it's a powerful process, and the ego will talk me out of it every time. I go, well, I'm mad at him, but I mean, you know, like on our evening review sheet, it says that we do with our group, we send a thing saying, did you do evening review? And it says, was I resentful? And if so, write inventory. So you start going, well, I wasn't really resentful, you know. They kind of bug me a little bit, you know, or something. Well, then let's do a bugs me inventory or something, but it's funny how the ego will tell me that this is going to take away from me. Am I the only one? Am I the only one that when you talk about that, I feel like I can get myself a little bit better deal than God's going to give me? You know, I mean, You know, when I think about God's will, my mind doesn't always go to joy and abundance and freedom and fulfillment. You know, it's just like, no, this is going to be a pain in the ass. You know, if I do that, I'm going to be out on the bull on a corner with a bullhorn and a Bible. But that's a chunk. When we look at the way self manifests, I guess if Katie's not here, I'll just keep going. Yeah. Keep in mind what we're doing in this whole exercise in the inventory process is trying to look at the way self manifests. And see how it comes out of that fourth column of the resentment inventory, where we see self over and over and over again. Now, so what about another example of the manifestations of fear? It says, manifestations of self. Notice that the word fear is bracketed along a lot of those resentments. This short word somehow touches every aspect of our life. It was, you know, remember, there's the garment district in New York, and all those guys were from New York. And it says it was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. Now, he uses that term three times in the big book. And I'm a competitive shotgun shooter. I'm thinking, I know what shot. I'm pictured, for some reason, I'm picturing like a piece of burlap cloth that's been shot through with the pellets. Well, but one day we read that line at Primary Purpose Group, and I said, look up the word shot, and it was the most amazing thing. It said, a method of weaving using warp and weft thread where the fabric takes on a different viewpoint, a different appearance depending upon the viewpoint of the observer. Oh, thanks, Chad. So, it was like one of those, we call it a Cheech and Chong moment at the group where, you know, we read that definition, everybody went, whoa, you know, because when it says shot through, this is a piece of shot fabric, and see how, you know, in one way it looks purple, and another way it looks blue, and so that's what it says, a method of weaving. So it's saying that fear is woven through the fabric of my existence, and not only is it woven, but it can change the way things look depending on how I'm looking at them, you know. No? Okay. But, so it says, fear set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. That never made sense to me for a long time until I heard somebody talking about one time they had been talking to this old-timer in AA that was dying. And he was like, and he said, you know, when you look back over, when you get to the close to the finish line, and you look back over your life, he goes, it's not the mistakes I made that I regret so deeply. He goes, it's the things I was afraid to try. And that's, you know, I forget who it was I was reading the other day, but he was saying, what if when we get to the judgment day, they compare the man I was to the man I could have been? I'm like, oh, come on, you know, yeah. But it's saying, but you know, when we look at all these things that I was afraid to try, you know, I wasn't willing to take the risk of this job, this relationship, this communication, whatever it is. And it says that fear ought to be classed with stealing. In that way, fear robs me of the experience I might have been able to have if I wasn't so blocked and driven. And then we refute our theories thoroughly. We put them on paper. The fear inventory is pretty simple. We just write down our fears, and then we ask ourselves why we have them. And then it kind of tells us the answer. It says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Well, self-reliance, if you turn around, is reliance on self. You know, so it says, you know, self is good as far as it goes, but there are certain things that I can't, there are some things I can control, probably not as much as I think, but the things that are outside of my control, without a power greater than myself, they scare the crap out of me. Cancer is a great example. You know, how my kids are going to turn out, whether or not people are going to gossip about me in AA, whether or not, you know, a lot of those things that are outside my control, I'm not going to say it, Kenny. Okay, I'm saying it. For years, I talked about this fear of areas that I have. I call it the fear sphere. Katie, hates it. Because she's like, you want to tell me this, what you can control? And I'm like, well, maybe it's a little bitty sphere, you know, but the stuff that falls, I've done it with the guys before where I go, this fear you wrote down, is that inside your area of control or outside your area of control? It's outside, 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 outside. If I can't control it, and what if there was a power that I could turn those things over to? Perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For we're now on a different basis. Remember when we talked about basis last time? Earlier it was talking about the basis of self-will, but now we're on the basis of what? The basis of trusting and relying upon God. And on that, it says we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. Just to the extent that we are in the world to play the role he assigns. You can do a lot of meditating around that line right there. Just playing the role that God assigns. What is my role today? Is it employer? Is it sponsor? Is it husband? Is it, you know, best friend? If I'm playing the role that God assigns, and how would I go about that? Just to the extent, I was doing inventory with a guy one time. This guy was handsome and president of a social organization at the University of Texas, and frankly, he got more action than the Dallas Cowboys. But we were doing his inventory, and in the same it's like Elaine. I was a, let's say, jerk. I was a jerk to her. Betty, I was a jerk to her. Girl in blue dress, I was a jerk to her. Girl downstairs, I was a jerk to her. You know, a short girl, I was a, you know, his whole inventory was like that. And I heard myself at one point going, how could we not be a jerk? And you know, this is getting more into the sex inventory, but it's like, what if that's what the whole sex inventory is about, is trying to shape a sane and sound ideal about our future sex life by looking at what hasn't worked in the past, you know? And that's, but it says, just the extent that we do as we think he would have us. I had somebody one time say, I got my stories mixed up there. I had somebody one time say, how do I know when I'm doing God's will? I said, you know, I don't really know the answer to that, but I generally know what's not God's will, you know. And I said, what if we just started off by not doing what's clearly not God's will and assume that the other stuff was close enough? And that's kind of what it says in the book. It says, just to the extent that we do is we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? I was listening to a guy that I listened to a lot, the other day he's going, you can't believe how much, unbelievably much better your life could get despite its current limitations and challenges if we just stop doing the things that we know are bad for us. I'm like, could we dance around that just a little bit more, you know? I mean, but it's like, exercise. That's a grand experiment. And then it says, we never apologize to anyone for depending on our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spiritually it says, instead, we let God demonstrate through us. Remember, it says that we're going to prove that this new basis, not only does it work, it proves it to the basis that the other, and remember it said demonstrate means to prove beyond the shadow of a doubt, to prove that the opposite viewpoint is rendered absurd. We let God demonstrate through us what he can do. So it's not only is it going to prove that God-reliance is better than self-reliance, it's going to prove it to the point that self-reliance is ridiculous. You know, and you go, oh, no thanks. I've tried that 950 times, you know. I think I've had my brains beat out enough. We ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. So the second manifestation of self that we look at, because keep in mind, all we're trying to do is fluff out this self piece. And how does it show up? Well, it shows up in resentments. It shows up in fear. And then it shows up in sex and harm. Do you want me to? 54 minutes.
Okay, we could have a break.
Well, I really kind of already covered the sex inventory. There's 9 questions.
I can get it.
And we're going to leave that for Quaidy. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break and get back in here. Thanks, everybody.